grandiose meals at Thanksgiving, often miss the target that should drive the deepest kinds of gratitude in our heart. Don't get me wrong, I am very thankful to be alive today. I don't take that for granted. And by the way, many have asked, have you heard anything from the doctors? Well, yes, the doctors have said, I have a clean bill of health as far as the things they're examining go. So if there's something else, I'm unaware, just like I was before all this started. But I am very thankful. I bet that comes up at our Thanksgiving meal this year. I'm thankful to be alive. It's very significant for us. I think when you gather with family, friends this week around Thanksgiving, you're going to be thankful for the enjoyment of your family, the possessions that you have, the good health that God has given, wonderful food and friends, abundance, freedoms, our nation, our church. There's many, many issues over which we should be genuinely grateful. And I hope you express that this week. And at the same time, we should be careful with our expressions of gratitude this week that we're not taking for granted the most eternal blessings for all of the temporal ones. Why would I say this? Have you ever thought in specific detail what it is that you and I deserve from God because of sin? Now, I know that we talk in generalities. Oh, I deserve the wrath of God. General. Have you ever thought what that might look like in specifics? Perhaps this passage could actually be one of the most helpful tools in stoking gratitude for eternal blessings. Not just the temporal ones that we will likely rehearse this week. Hopefully we'll see that, and I want to urge that by the end of this message. So let's start by reminding ourselves where we are in our study of the book of Revelation. 22 chapters in this book. The first three chapters describe events that are happening right now in the age of the church. John describes them as the things which are, what the Spirit is now saying to the churches. Chapters 4 through 22 describe events that will happen, as John says, after these things, after the age of the church, after the things that are. That's chapters 4 through 22. And when we began to look at the future things, we were ushered into heaven, into the throne room of God in chapters 4 and 5, which happens to be the headquarters from which judgment will come in the end. We saw the Father on the throne, and we saw the Lamb take from the Father's hand the scroll with the seven seals, and he began to break the seven seals, and with every seal would come a particular judgment from God. These seven seals comprise a seven-year time span, as Daniel 9 reminds us of, and John describes that seven-year period in terms of two periods of 3.5 years, or 1,260 days, or 42 months. The first six seals comprise the first 3.5 year period. Seals 5 and 6 are the midpoint and begin to tip us into the next part of the wrath of God in the last 3.5 years. As we began looking at last time, the seventh seal, when it's broken in chapter 8, verses 1 and 2, opens up that final 3.5 year period by unleashing seven angels who possess seven different trumpets of judgment. And when each of the seven angels blow their ram's horn trumpet, another more severe judgment is breathed out from God's throne onto the earth. These seven trumpet judgments begin in chapter 8, and they will go all the way through chapter 11 to the end of that chapter that describes, in a very broad way, the return of Jesus Christ. So we looked at the first four trumpet judgments the last time we were together in this study. They were judgments from God on the creation by using the creation itself. God limits what the land produces, what the sea produces, what the fresh water produces, what the sky produces. When we turn away from our Creator, we tend to then worship what He has made. And in the end, He'll take what has been made that we tend to worship to His exclusion, and He will turn it on us and use it as a tool of judgment on the earth. That was the first four of the seven trumpets, but the final three are yet to come. And they will turn the attention from the created world onto humanity directly. Not just the natural world, but now it will focus on God's direct affliction of humanity with increasing intensity as we move through them. Now this morning we're only going to focus on the fifth trumpet. It's a judgment of terrorizing torment on humanity. It is a judgment where God will unleash hell on earth. And when we're finished seeing it, hopefully you would stop and say, I'm grateful that Christ has saved me. Revelation 8:13 through 9:12 describes the terrorizing torment of the fifth trumpet, the unleashing of hell on earth. So what's described in the trumpet? What's described here? Well, John makes five descriptions that emphasize the terror of demonic torment during the final days of God's judgment. That's what you'll see in the fifth trumpet. Descriptions that emphasize the terror of demonic torment during the final days of God's judgment. We'll look at each of these descriptions one at a time. There are five of them for us to consider. Let's look at the first description together. First, the fifth trumpet is connected to final wrath. Look at verse 13. The fifth trumpet is connected to final wrath. Then I looked, and that's the normal phrase for "and I saw" that we've seen many, many times. And I saw, and I heard, an eagle flying in mid-heaven saying with a loud voice, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound." John says, I saw again. It's another scene in the vision that's unfolding for him. And I heard an eagle flying in mid-heaven. It's a strange way to describe what he is seeing. I heard an eagle flying. That's what I saw. He saw it, and he heard what he saw. An eagle that was flying in mid-heaven, beginning to say over and over and over, "Woe, woe, woe to those who dwell on the earth." Well, why an eagle? And should we see this as a literal eagle flying in mid-heaven? Or is this some kind of allegorical expression of something other than an eagle? Already in the book of Revelation, we have seen that one of the four living creatures in Revelation 4:7 had the face of a flying eagle, because he is an angelic being in heaven before God's throne, and he stands representative of all of God's rule over all created life. We've seen something similar, but that was an angelic being at the throne room of God, not in mid-heaven. When we get to Revelation 12, we'll see this next year. Next year. We'll see Revelation 12 describes a sign. So he specifically says, I'm going to talk about some symbols, a sign. And he describes a woman who has two wings of a great eagle so she can fly into the wilderness to escape the dragon, that is Satan. There are a few references in the Old Testament prophets that refer to eagles who are connected to God's judgment on the earth and even the day of the Lord. You could jot down Hosea chapter 8 verse 1. Even this reference that refers to an eagle also refers to a trumpet. Put the trumpet to your lips like an eagle. The enemy comes against the house of the Lord because they've transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. It could be that God is just using one of the beings of the created world to express coming judgment, because he's done that in the past, and that's an image that expresses that. But in our passage, you can note very carefully, there's no words like or as. There's no comparison here of this eagle. It is an eagle. It's doing what an eagle does, flying in mid-heaven, but it's going beyond what a normal eagle does. This eagle is saying something. You say, yeah, eagles don't talk, at least the ones I've seen. They don't talk. They don't speak. So this must be some kind of angelic being, but be careful with that. Be careful with that. We've seen a serpent speak in the Bible, have we not? And if that's just an allegorical expression for something other than what it is, we have major problems with how we're going to interpret the Old Testament. We've seen a donkey speak in the Old Testament as well. This is not the first time you would see some animate object like this speak. In fact, if you were to see something like this, if you were to see an eagle flying in mid-heaven, and he's crying out with a voice that you could understand, would you think, that must be allegorical for an American jet? Or would you think, God is doing something? This is supernatural. This is divine. This is not normal. This is not natural. This is obviously something expressing that God himself is up to something. He's flying in mid-heaven. That's where the birds of the air fly. It's not the throne room of God. It's above the earth. It's in the sky. And he's saying with a loud voice, again, you'd do good to go through the book of Revelation and look at all the people saying things with a loud voice. It's a loud, loud book. Obviously, this eagle flying in mid-heaven is speaking to the whole earth. And he says, woe, woe, woe. These are onomatopoeic terms. You know what that is? That's where the meaning of the word is derived from how it sounds. I mean, what's the meaning of the word buzz or smack? You know what it is because of how it sounds. That's this term, woe. It should be something like a moaning from pain, a groaning from being painfully tortured. It's a term that Jesus used to pronounce judgment on cities like Chorazin and Bethsaida. He pronounced a woe on the world and to the Pharisees, as we read in the gospel accounts. It's a note of divine judgment on them, a woe. You should be warned. It's a cry of pain, a moan and groan. And here, it's not like Jesus when he gave it in the gospel accounts where he said, woe to Bethsaida, woe to Chorazin. Here the eagle says it three times in a superlative fashion. Woe, 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 it's a curse from God. You think back, how bad were the first four trumpets? When the whole creation seems to be erupting on creation. They're pretty bad. How much worse is it about to become? Where now a supernatural eagle in heaven is pronouncing three divine woes, that must mean something greater and more intense is coming. God is turning his judgment on the population of the world itself, and this eagle is pronouncing the worst, most intense, most torturous, painful expressions of judgment yet to come. And we'll see that each of these three woes correspond to each of the three last trumpets. It's obvious when you get down to verse 12, the first woe is past that corresponds to the fifth trumpet. Behold, two woes are still coming. That would be the sixth and the seventh trumpets. You'll see that again at the end of chapter 11, verse 14. The second woe is past and the third woe is coming. Interestingly, after the third woe is enacted, there's no statement like this saying that the third woe is past. And that's likely because the seventh angel and the seventh woe, when he pronounces his judgment, unleashes the worst of the worst of the worst, and it's the final of final wrath. And it's seven bowls of judgment, which are described in the book of Revelation as God's ultimate pinnacle point of wrath. That seventh angel and that seventh woe will encompass what we read in chapters 12 through 22. The Bible's just filtering us down from one judgment to the next so that we get into that last judgment. We'll spend a significant amount of time unpacking what happens in the final woe. Notice to whom the woes are addressed in verse 13. Who should be worried? Who's under the attack of God? To those who dwell on the earth. To those who dwell on the earth. We've seen this phrase before. It's a technical phrase throughout the book of Revelation that refers to unrepentant, unbelieving people on the earth during the days of the tribulation. It's mentioned in chapter 3, chapter 6, chapter 8, chapter 11, chapter 13, and chapter 17. To those who dwell on the earth, it's the unbelieving of the earth. If you looked at all of its references, it's a clear technical term to the unbelieving. This is judgment reserved for those who continue to rebel against God, even in the expression of his wrath, the worst expression of his wrath on the earth. They will not repent. Why should they fear? Well, the text tells us why. Because of the remaining blasts of the trumpet of the three angels who are about to sound. These three angels are essentially the final three angels of God's wrath. Each of the three trumpets intensifies the judgment of God until that judgment brings Christ back. So when the fifth trumpet sounds, we're on the downhill side of judgment. We're on the downhill side of approaching the return of Christ and the final expressions of God's wrath. And as we're going to see, there is a duration to this trumpet. It describes here in verses 5 and 10 as 5 months. So it's not just a rapid fire, quick and easy judgment. It endures for a time before the next trumpet judgment begins. But the clock of humanity's existence, apart from Christ's rule on the earth, it's ticking. And the fifth trumpet signals the final expression of God's wrath. It's coming. So look at a second description. The second description of the fifth trumpet judgment is this. The fifth trumpet unleashes the worst of the demonic. The fifth trumpet unleashes the worst of the demonic. Look at verse 1 of chapter 9. Then the fifth angel sounded, and I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth, and the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. He opened the bottomless pit, and smoke went up out of the pit, like the smoke of a great furnace, and the sun and the air were darkened by the smoke of the pit. When the fifth angel that had been standing before God's throne and who had been handed a trumpet, trumpets, John says, I saw a star from heaven which had fallen to the earth. Now, we've seen stars already, have we not, in the book of Revelation? It's an intriguing phrase. It's loaded with biblical allusion here, and we want to look at this specifically so we know exactly what's going on here. We've even seen stars falling thus far in the book of Revelation, have we not? Chapter 6, verse 13, there were stars of the sky that fell to the earth. They're connected to astronomical events, likely referring to an asteroid, a meteor falling to the earth. Chapter 8, verses 10 and 11, refers to a great star that fell from heaven. That could be angelic, could be a reference to an angel. Most likely it's an asteroid, a meteor that fell into the waters and made them bitter, because the people, after they see this star fall into the waters, they name it Wormwood because it makes the waters bitter. It's not likely a personal being. Chapter 8, verse 12, we note that a third of the stars in the sky were struck, and those stars were connected to the sun and the moon so that they did not shine. That's likely the stars of the sky. But this star in chapter 9, verse 1, if you pay close attention to the text itself, it describes it in very different terminology than any of the other stars that have fallen to the earth. Notice that when this star had fallen, a key of the bottomless pit was given. What's the last phrase of verse 1? To him. To him. And then it says in verse 2, he, using a personal pronoun, he opened the bottomless pit. This star is personal. And John notes, this star once was in heaven, But now when he sees it, this star is on the earth. It had fallen from heaven to the earth. Something about this star indicated that one time it was in heaven, or he was in heaven. And now he, this star, as John sees it, has fallen to the earth. The Greek verb tense for fallen suggests that John did not see the star actually fall. He's seeing it after the fall had occurred. It's fallen. It had fallen and it remains there. That's the tense of the verb. John didn't see it fall. The star seems personal. It's likely an angelic person because he was originally from heaven. And even that's not new in the book of Revelation. If you go back to chapter 1 and you look at chapter 1, verse 16 and 20, Jesus was holding seven stars in his right hand. And who are the seven stars? They're the seven angelic beings, angels, heavenly angels that are attached to the seven churches who would bring the revelation of God to these churches. They're mentioned in chapter 1, verse 16, verse 20, chapter 2, verse 1, chapter 3, verse 1. So angels have already been connected to stars. It's not the first time that we've seen that. It's not the first time heavenly angels are referred to as stars. We'll see it again in chapter 12. Look over there for just a moment. Since we won't get to it next year, let's at least talk about it. Look at chapter 12, verse 3. Then another sign appeared in heaven, and this is a sign. It's obviously meant to be some kind of symbolic expression. It appeared in heaven, and behold, a great red dragon having seven heads, 10 horns, and on his heads were 7 diadems. And what's good about Revelation, he's going to tell you what these things are eventually, so you don't have to wonder. But notice what he says in verse 4, and his tail swept away a third of the stars of heaven. Now, who is the dragon? Well, we're told later, this is Satan. And he swept away a third of the stars of heaven and threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was about to give birth so that when she gave birth, he might devour her child. So this is some kind of symbolic expression of Satan and his tail of this dragon sweeping a third of the stars. And we'll see later in chapter 12 that refers to angels who serve with him on the earth. And we'll look at that in just a moment. But you'll see it later in chapter 12. This is very reminiscent of the prophet Isaiah. Jot down Isaiah chapter 14. Isaiah 14, interesting description that I think can rightly be understood to refer to the fall of Satan, who used to be an angelic being in heaven, and he fell to the earth. Isaiah chapter 14, verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You have been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. But you said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. I will raise my throne above the stars of God, and I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will make myself like the Most High. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. The language in Isaiah seems to refer to something greater than some human ruler, but something, someone who had an existence in heaven. The star that had fallen to the earth that John sees is likely Satan, the dragon. Jesus even mentions this very idea in his gospel account, Luke chapter 10, verse 17. Luke 10, 17. After he had sent out the 70 disciples to serve and to minister, the 70 returned with joy, saying, Lord, listen to this. You can imagine the scene. Lord, even the demons are subject to us in your name. That'd be fun, wouldn't it? The demons are subject to us. And Jesus said to them, I was watching Satan fall from heaven like lightning. He goes on to remind them, don't rejoice that you have power over demons. Be weary of people who rejoice in that kind of thing. Rejoice that your names are written in the book of heaven. Rejoice that you're saved. But Jesus said, I saw Satan fall from heaven. If you think back to the book of Genesis, in creation, there was a period of time between the seventh day when everything was very good. Remember that comment? It was all good, meaning there wasn't anything sinful that existed at the end of the creation week. Somewhere between that seventh day and chapter 3, when the serpent is tempting Eve, the fall of Satan took place, where he fell from heaven to the earth in order to deceive the nations. In other places in the scripture, we learn that in this time, as Satan has originally fallen from heaven to the earth, he still seems to have access to heaven. We see him in the book of Job, and he's presenting himself before God along with other sons of God, likely references to angels. And there he's asking God, could I not have my way with Job? So he has access to heaven. But it seems that during the time of the tribulation, and probably during the last 3.5 years of it, Satan will be cast down finally from heaven, no longer gaining access to heaven before he's eventually locked away for 1,000 years, as Revelation chapter 20 describes, and then after that released, where he will then be tormented for eternity in the lake of fire. Again, look at chapter 12 just for a moment so you can put your eyes on that. Look at verse 7. There was war in heaven, Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war. Notice, the dragon and his angels. This is a reference to him taking with his tail a third of the stars of heaven. Their angels, again, are connected to the stars. There was war in heaven, and Michael and his angels were waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough, and there was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down. And who is the great dragon? The serpent of old. It's a reference to Genesis, isn't it? Who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world. And he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. Notice how many times it's saying he's thrown down. Thrown down. Verse 10, then I heard a loud voice in heaven saying, now the salvation and the power and the kingdom of our God and the authority of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren has been thrown down, he who accuses them before our God day and night. So that indicates that there was a time in which he had access to God where he was accusing the brethren day and night, but now he no longer has that, at least at this time period where he's thrown down. Verse 11, they overcame him because of the blood of the Lamb, because of the word of their testimony, and they did not love their life even when faced with death. That's referring to those tribulation saints who are dying under the persecution of Satan and his angels. Because Satan had been thrown down. So chapter 9, verse 1, is likely John seeing an indication of Satan after he had been cast down from heaven, never allowed to have access to God again like he previously had to accuse the brethren in this way. And when he was cast down, and as he's in this cast down position, do you notice chapter 9, verse 1 again? And the key of the bottomless pit was given to him. Actually, in the phrase in Greek, the word given to him is first, as if it's emphasized. Given to him. Who gave it to him? Who gave this angel who had fallen to the earth? Who gave Satan the key to the bottomless pit? It's a passive verse, passive voice verb here, likely meaning God did. It's what theologians refer to as the divine passive. God did this. God gave Satan the key. That is authority. The key means he had the ability to open and to close, to bind and to loose. That's the language connected with keys in the Bible. He had the ability to take this bottomless pit and open it up and unleash whatever's inside of it, or close it and keep it closed so that whatever's inside there can't come out, given to Satan. Obviously, this is a specific place in the timeline of God's wrath where God says, now I'm going to allow, I'm even going to instruct the devil what to do in unleashing judgment on the earth. What is this bottomless pit? The key to the bottomless pit was given to him. Well, bottomless pit is one word in Greek. This is literally the pit of the abyss. The abyss is the term translated here as bottomless. It means without depth. It's a reference to the lower parts of the earth where the souls of the departed dead perhaps will reside. And normally the wicked dead are there. Romans 10:7 refers to the place of the dead as being the abyss. In the book of Revelation, the word abyss is used seven times. Twice here in verses 1 and 2. It'll be used again in verse 11, which we'll look at in a moment. And then it will be used in chapter 11, verse 7, and chapter 17, verse 8, where the beast is connected to this bottomless pit. The beast comes up from this bottomless pit, or this abyss. Interestingly, in chapter 20, verses 1 and 3, it is the abyss where another angel will come down from God, and he will lock away Satan into the abyss for 1,000 years, then release Satan from the abyss for one final blow. Every reference in the book of Revelation seems to connect the abyss to Satan himself. In this instance, the key of the pit of the abyss was given to him. Satan has given this key, and God did it. Well, what's in this pit? Well, outside the book of Revelation, there's one significant text that mentions the abyss. You can jot down Luke chapter 8. In Luke 8, verses 30 and 31, Jesus encounters a man who is possessed by demons. In fact, we learn in verse 30, he's possessed by a legion of demons, many, many demons. You remember those demons began to speak to Christ. In verse 31, it says they were imploring Christ not to command them to go away into the abyssos, the abyss. Same word. The demons hate the abyss. The demons don't want to go to the abyss. If demons don't like it, it must be really, really bad, wouldn't you think? They don't want to go there. Interestingly, Peter mentions a pit where demons were cast and imprisoned, a place where they would be kept, and a place reserved for judgment. And Peter refers to the book of Genesis when he talks about this pit. In 2 Peter 2:4, for if God did not spare, listen to this, if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but threw them down into hell and committed them to pits of darkness reserved for judgment. Again, Revelation 20 calls the abyss a pit that's reserved for Satan until his final judgment. Jude 6 mentions this pit for these angels who did not keep, Jude 6, angels who did not keep their own domain but abandoned their proper abode. He has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day. What does that mean? Well, there's a place where some demons, not all demons, but some who evidently have committed some heinous sin, so heinous, so vile, that you could probably connect back to the book of Genesis, and I would suggest that connects us back to Genesis chapter 6, where humans were indwelt by demonic beings, began to interact with some of the women, and the giants were ruling the land at that time. These demons were then cast into the abyss and reserved for the time of judgment. I don't think there's any good demons in the Bible. Being a demon means you're not good, right? I mean, you call your children little demon. You're not meaning to encourage them by that term. You might think carefully before you use that phrase about your children. But there are some demons not allowed to be roaming the earth because of how vile and wicked and sinful they are. They exceed that of all the other demons. And they're only going to be released, or they're only going to be dealt with in the judgment. How heinous must these demons be? How vile must they be? These must be the worst of the worst, the fiercest, most sinful, and vile creatures of the demonic world under the rule of Satan himself. And think about what's going on here in Revelation 9. God is judging the unbelieving world, those who dwell on the earth, those who will not repent. And he's about to use the worst that hell has to offer to afflict them. And look what Satan does. Verse 2, he opens the bottomless pit. He opens the pit of the abyss, and smoke went up out of the pit like the smoke of a great furnace. We know that Jesus referred to the place of the wicked dead, or hell, as a place of unquenchable fire and torment where these creatures are kept. It's just like that. The phrase "a great furnace" is used a couple of other times in the Bible. You'll see it used in the book of Genesis to describe Sodom and Gomorrah. In Genesis 19:28, the smoke of the land ascended like the smoke of a furnace. It's also used when the Lord descended onto Mount Sinai and Moses was going to receive the law from God. God threatened judgment to anyone who would even touch the mountain, right? The mountain was smoking like the smoke of a great furnace. The smoke of a furnace refers to the place of God's judgment. This is real smoke of an actual furnace-like place that is so terrible that when it is opened, that great furnace opens up and the smoke that rises blots out the sun and makes the air thick, almost unbreathable. What is all of this suggesting? What's being unleashed on the world? It's the worst that hell has to offer. It's the worst of the demonic. And God is governing it. Do you see that? He's governing it. He gave the key to Satan so that Satan would unleash it. And you might say, but wait a minute. Why would Satan unleash this kind of terrible evil on people who serve him? Doesn't he like them? You're assuming Satan likes something? And especially, why would he ever like anyone created in the image of God? He doesn't. He longs to pour out torment on anyone who bears the image of God. He hates God so virulently. But he's also under constraint by God's order to unleash hellish judgment when God says, and to an extent that God allows. It's interesting that those who take a purely allegorical approach to the book of Revelation say that what is being unleashed here are false teachers. From the ascension of Christ until his return, these are false teachers who peddle false doctrine. And if you take it as that, it almost strips the language of any sensical meaning here. It diminishes the intensity and the divinity of what's happening here, the divine nature of it. It ignores the details of what is said. This is not symbolic of something like the spread of false teaching. This is an expression of God's wrath towards sin and sinful people. How great is human sin? How intense is God's wrath toward human sin if in the end he will unleash the worst that hell has to offer? Brings us to a third description. A third description that emphasizes demonic terrorizing torment in the fifth trumpet judgment. Third, the fifth trumpet applies an agonizing torment. it applies an agonizing torment. That's what we see in verses 3 to 6. Then, verse 3, out of the smoke came locusts upon the earth. As the smoke rises and blots out the sun and thickens the air, it reveals a massive, innumerable swarm of locusts, like grasshoppers, which is one of the worst kinds of plagues that the earth experiences, where swarms of these insects can wipe out an entire region, leaving them completely devastated of any crops of which to live. He said, but wait, I thought we were saying that this pit contained the worst of the demonic world. Why locusts? Well, we're going to see in a moment, these are not merely natural locusts. They have the appearance of locusts, but they're supernatural demonic beings. And the Bible would use a term like locust and an image like locust. And God would use something actually expressing the image of a locust so that your mind would rush to all the places in the Bible where locusts are seen as divine judgment. Exodus chapter 10 and the plagues over Egypt. Locusts come and they devour the crops of the land because of Egypt's unbelief. In Deuteronomy chapter 28, when Israel sins and they rebel against God, God says, one of the plagues I'm going to bring against you is like that I brought against the Egyptians, and I'll bring locusts to devour your crops so you'll know that I'm in control and you have sinned. Judges chapter 6, verses 1 to 5, describes the Midianite armies to be like locusts. They devour everything of all the crops that the Israelites produce so the Israelites have nothing to eat. In Jeremiah 51, in verses 14 and 27, Babylon is said to be destroyed by the Medes, who are compared to a locust plague from God. Even more, there are references to locusts in some of the minor prophets, like Joel. Joel chapter 1 describes a locust infestation that would come and attack Israel as a sign of what God would do in judgment. And in chapter 2, verse 25, locusts are connected to the day of the Lord. When God comes in judgment, he'll release locusts onto the earth. Now we're going to see in a moment in verses 7 to 11 in Revelation 9 that these are not human armies. These are not normal insects, and they're not some allegorical expression of false teachers. They're otherworldly demonic beings who've been locked away for this very moment who take on the appearance of locusts. It's not the first time you've seen demons do something like that. You'll see them appear like frogs later on, or they can take on human-type forms in the Gospels or other places. But notice what these locusts do. They're not like normal locusts. Verse 3, as they come upon the earth, it says, power was given to them, as the scorpions of the earth have power, and they were told not to hurt the grass of the earth, nor any green thing, nor any tree, but only the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. You see, power was given to them. That's literally the word authority. Authority was given to them. They were given. Who do you think gave them authority? Who grants authority? The ultimate authority. This is another divine passive. God is allowing these locusts to have authority. Under the rule of Satan, God allows this. They're given authority, and that authority is limited to sting, to strike with a painful kind of venom. And it's only to strike the men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads, which is likely a reference to chapter 7 and the 144,000, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel who are being preserved in the great tribulation as witnesses of God to Israel. They will not be hurt at all. And you say, well, what about others? Well, remember, it's likely that those who become believers during this time of the great tribulation are martyred very quickly. And we're also told already in the fifth trumpet that all of this judgment is only on those who dwell on the earth, which is the technical term for the unbelieving. So this locust creature only affects the unbelieving of the earth. And what is this sting like? Look at verse 5. They were not permitted to kill anyone, but to torment for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it stings a man. And in those days, men will seek death and they will not find it, and they will long to die and death flees from them. The sting doesn't bring any death. It's way worse than that. It's way worse than that. They torment people for 5 months. Perhaps that's how long the locust demon plague lasts, or is that the degree or the length of time that the sting lasts? It doesn't necessarily say, but 5 months is the normal lifespan of a typical locust, so perhaps that's where the image comes from. But what I see here is that God, while he allows this torment to take place, he limits it. You almost think back to Job, don't you? You can do up to this degree with Job, and no more. You say, well, why 5 months? Because God said 5 months. Some interpreters say this means for a little while. Well, I don't think it means for a little while, because of all the authors of the New Testament, the Apostle John uses the phrase for a little while more than any other author. And if he meant for a little while, he would have said that here. Because he will use that term in chapter 6, verse 11, and chapter 17, verse 10, when he means a little while. One interpreter actually says that 5 months includes all the time between Christ's ascension to heaven and his return to the earth. And he's the same, and along with the same interpreters who say 1,000 years means a long term, long time, and it means between the ascension of Christ and his return to the earth. So 5 months and 1,000 years is all the same. Again, that's not a good way to try to interpret the Bible. 5 months means about 5 months, as we understand months, because later he'll talk about 42 months or 1,260 days. I mean, he's not imprecise when he talks about timing in the book of Revelation. So for 5 months, this torture reigns. For 5 months, no death comes from these torturous demonic beings, just torment, pain, and a pain that is like a perpetual scorpion sting that makes men want to die. In fact, I think the language here says they're running after death. They want to take their own life. You say, well, they could take their life if they want to. No, it seems like they're limited by God. Death flees from them. As hard as they're running after death, death runs away from them. God doesn't let them die, though they want to die. It's a torment that's unthinkable. It's not eternal. It's 5 months. So what will eternal torment be like? If this is far less than that, what will eternal torment be like? So what is emphasized here in these verses? The fifth trumpet judgment is one of agonizing torment. What must this say about what God thinks about the punishment of sinful rebellion that it deserves? If this is the temporal kind of agony experienced for a short time during the great tribulation, what will eternal torment be like? In other words, we're meant to fear this. We're to consider the pain that sin deserves and understand how serious God takes rebellion in his creation. Sin deserves the unleashing of hell itself on those who reject the God of heaven. Let's look at a fourth description of this judgment. Fourth, the fifth trumpet displays unimaginable terror. Unimaginable terror. This is a description in verses 7 to 11 that reveals that these locusts are otherworldly, not merely insects, but locust-like. You will notice the terms like and as repeatedly in the description. Verse 11, the appearance, or literally that is the likeness of the locusts, was like horses. On their heads appeared to be crowns like gold. Their faces were like the faces of men. Verse 8, they had hair like the hair of women. Their teeth were like the teeth of lions. Verse 9, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. The sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots. Verse 10, they have tails like scorpions. John is attempting to describe the indescribable. He's picturing the unimaginable. And the clear emphasis in each of the descriptions is that of something terrifying. He first says that the appearance of the locusts was like horses prepared for battle, horses that had always been prepared. They'd already been prepared. They exist for the purpose of battle. These demonic beings were prepared for this moment to do battle against the unbelieving of the earth. He says, on their heads appear to be crowns like gold. Well, we've already seen in verse 3, they were given authority. This expresses their authority that has been given to them to strike men. Their faces are like the faces of men. They were not actually human, but they had faces like people. Don't forget that demons in Scripture are able to take the form of a variety of animate beings as God designs them to take on. People, frogs, we'll see a variety of it. They had hair like the hair of women, long flowing hair with human faces, crowns of authority, arrayed like an army, teeth like the teeth of lions. Do you think when you see a lion roaring and exposing his teeth that you just want to go up and pet him? No. It's terrorizing. Verse 9, they had breastplates like breastplates of iron. Their thorax, literally the Greek is referring to their thorax. It's like a thorax of iron. It was like iron, like it was plated like their soldiers. The sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots of many horses rushing to battle. The military loves for their planes to sound loud and inspire fear. That's why they sound this way, to inspire fear and terror. Verse 10, they have the tails like scorpions and stings, and their tails is the power to hurt men for 5 months. We've seen that description already in verses 3 and 5. Here it's a third time. I think we're supposed to take it like it says it right here. Verse 11 is incredibly terrorizing. They have a king over them, the angel of the abyss. And his name in Hebrew is Abaddon, and in Greek He has the name Apollyon. Just as verse 10 is a corresponding description to the scorpion-like sting already mentioned in verses 3 and 5, verse 11 is a corresponding description to the fallen star who holds the key to the pit of the abyss back in verses 1 and 2. The best evidence, I think, is to see this angel as the fallen star of the first two verses. The fallen star was given a key, meaning he had authority. Now we see the king who rules over these demonic beings, and he's able to open and close the shaft of the abyss to keep them in or let them out. He has authority. His name is Abaddon. It's simply a Hebrew term, refers to a place connected to death, the place of the dead. Apollyon is a Greek term used only here, and it refers to one who is the destroyer. Both terms refer to one who is the destroyer. Who is it that Jesus said in Matthew 12, 24 is the prince of the demons, the ruler of the demons? It's Satan. Who is the prince of the power of the air who now exists on the earth, ruling over the earth? Ephesians 2, 2, it's Satan. He's not tied to this one place during the Great Tribulation, but he has authority over it. And God is using Satan to unleash his judgment over the unbelieving of the earth. No, these are not Apache helicopters or Cobra helicopters like Hal Lindsey said. This is not an apt description of a powerful false teacher or a string of them for spreading false doctrine from the ascension of Jesus to its end. This is not an imaginative description of the geographically isolated destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. This is an apt description of demonic terror at the rising peak of God's final judgment on the earth. It may be one of the most terrorizing descriptions of torment in the Bible. You should fear the coming wrath of God. You should fear it. You should think about it. The fifth description comes in verse 12. The fifth trumpet promises additional judgment. How much worse can it get? Well, John says the first woe is past. 5 months. It passes. Behold, two woes are still coming after these things. Oh, if that's the first of three, can only imagine. And you will, because it goes into great detail to describe it. More is to come. So again, happy Thanksgiving. You're welcome. Why should we know this? Why do we have to see this? And why even do it this week? Now, don't put your Bible away yet. Why? Well, let me give you a couple of suggestions. One, don't doubt the reality of the demonic world. Don't doubt the reality of the demonic world and its evil and active role. We may not be able to see it now, but when God lets us see it, it will terrorize humanity. It is real. It is active. Don't be so arrogant as to think you can walk out there and start telling demons what to do either. They're under the authority of God to do as he designs and he sees. Remember, Jesus told the disciples, don't run out there arrogantly priding yourself in what power you have over the demonic world. Just be thankful that your names are written in heaven. Second, we do see God's direct control even over the demonic world. They can only do what he says they can do and for how long he says they can do it. He's in total control of judgment. Third, you should see in this terrorizing torment the holiness of God. You should see here the holiness of God. That holiness that has been offended and hated by humanity, rejected and smeared by the very people created to bear the image of God. The degree of God's holiness requires an equal degree of judgment. How high is his holiness? Well, you will see it in how dark is judgment for smearing his holiness. The fact that this terrorizing description is the first of three final waves, and each wave becomes even more intense, ending in eternal torment, should give you a glimpse into the degree of God's holiness that has been offended and the heinousness of sin against God's holiness. Fourth, you should see in all of this terror, apart from Christ, we deserve this. This is what we deserve apart from Christ, because we've all sinned. We have all fallen short of the glory of God. Don't dumb down your descriptions of God's wrath. John uses vivid imagery because you should think, this is what I deserve. So let's think fifth. This is what Jesus died to save you from. When you think about the details of God's wrath, it should elevate the immensity of his grace. Because we do deserve this. And only the sinless life of Jesus offered on the cross in your place, appropriating his righteousness when you have faith in Christ and what he did to atone for all your sins, because only the life of Christ propitiates or assuages the wrath of God that we are seeing the tip of here. Yeah. Only Christ. This is what he died to save you from. This is why I think it's not inappropriate to study this on the week of Thanksgiving. How intense should your Thanksgiving be this week? What has he saved you from? And this is just the tip, the 5-month tip. What's eternal judgment like that he has saved you from? Do tears come to your eyes when you see how you have sinned against God? And now he, through the life of his own son, has covered your sin? When you deserve this and much, much more? Yeah, think on the wrath of God this week so that you will savor the salvation of Christ this week. And if you're not in Christ, do you not see how desperate you actually are for him? He's told you in the pages of the Bible, this is what's coming. Turn. Because the loving arms of the Savior will not reject anyone who comes by faith, but everyone who comes by faith, he'll take in. And he'll save you, and he'll cover your sin, and he'll bring you into eternal glory and joy ever increasing, rather than ever increasing torment in hell. I think we have a lot to be thankful for, don't you? Father, as we finish this time and we now turn our attention to the Lord's table, and we take of the elements that remind us of what you, our God, have done for us, would you help us? Help us to be grateful. Help us to be people of faith whose faith is even stronger because we see what you in your magnanimous mercy and grace have done to undeserving people like us. Help us enjoy this time around the table, a table of thanksgiving for us who know Christ, a table that invites those without Christ to come to him in faith, the demonstration of who we are.